All right. So welcome everybody. We are looking at the doctor's opinion tonight. We've met in our groups. We've discussed questions with our facilitators, and now we're going to go over the content. Please understand that this is my interpretation, my experience with this. I highly encourage you to continue to study this book, study these pages. Have your own experience and your own interpretation of what this really means to you. It's of utmost importance. What I say may land, it may spark your spirit, but it's very important for each and every one of you to have your own experience with this. I'd like to say a prayer before we start. Thank you so much, Father, for bringing us together tonight. Thank you for giving these participants the willingness to show up, to go through this workshop, to take the time to recover. I ask that you allow my words to land on open hearts and open minds, that you guide me, that you allow me to be a channel and a vessel of your power and share my experience with them. In your name we pray. Amen. So we talked about the set-aside prayer last week. Tonight, we are going to look at the physical allergy. So our set-aside prayer will go something like this. God, please enable me to set aside everything I think I know for a new experience and an open mind. Please show me the truth about what happens to me after I take the first drink. Now, if this is an open workshop tonight, the words in the book are going to be alcohol. I encourage you that if that is not necessarily your affliction, to please replace it. You can even replace it in your own book, replace it in your mind. The solution is the same. So let me mute Michael here. The solution is the same for all of us. So basically, we're looking at what happens to us after we take the first drink, the first drug, the first bite of food, the first action of codependency, the first action of controlling and fixing, whatever it may be. Please recognize this insatiable desire for more and how it's beyond our will to control it, because that's what we're talking about tonight. At the top of the doctor's opinion, we wrote step one, physical craving of my body. Page, Roman numeral 25. To the top of paragraph 23 or page 23. The first step begins here. We start by using the doctor's opinion as a tool by turning the statements into questions to look at what happens to me after I take the first drink. Nothing to do with what I was thinking at the time. Look mainly at what happened. The consideration is, do I lose control of my drinking after I take the first drink? Or can I control how much I drink after I've started? So maybe I'm not an alcoholic. So it's something for all of us to consider. We're not here to diagnose you. We are not here to profess a disease over you. It is solely up to you to go through this process and come to terms with whether you are or aren't an alcoholic. So this is the doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. So in this chapter, we are hearing from a medical expert who is dealing with alcoholism in a hospital, which is what makes it so important. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcohol and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who thought he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless. So this was Bill Wilson, who went to see Dr. Silkworth. And in Dr. Silkworth's experience, here stood in front of him once again an alcoholic that was hopeless, that he was unable to help. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. So Bill Wilson, after his first round with Dr. Silkworth, ended up meeting his friend, Ebby Thatcher, who told him about the spiritual solution to alcoholism. So at this point, this letter is talking about how Bill came back to the hospital for the third time. And the doctor was amazed at the recovery he had achieved and what he was doing to achieve this. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now they asked Dr. Silkworth to write a chapter for their book. At that time, there was only 100, and we call them the first 100. As they were writing their book, Bill Wilson went back to Dr. Silkworth and said, "Can you please write a chapter about what you told me and how you helped me in my recovery?" So Dr. Silkworth wrote what we're reading tonight. I personally know scores of cases who are of a type with whom other methods had failed completely. So Silkworth has seen hundreds and hundreds of other alcoholics that they've tried and tried and tried to help them, and they could not. And he gave Bill Wilson the same information that he had given all these other alcoholics. But through the grace of God, when Bill Wilson left that hospital, he came in contact with a friend that shared with him a spiritual solution. And Bill took that spiritual solution and combined it with the information that we're going to talk about tonight. And Alcoholics Anonymous was born. This information by itself is only self-knowledge. What we're going to talk about tonight about this physical craving can be classified as only self-knowledge. And it wasn't enough for these alcoholics to recover. Bill Wilson experienced a spiritual solution that was born in the Oxford group, and he combined them. And that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance. What facts? The facts that Bill Wilson found a way to recover after all these years of these doctors trying to help these alcoholics, because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch on the annals of alcoholism. So right away, Dr. Silkworth is recognizing this can change the whole game. This spiritual solution, which I knew was required, I did not know how to give it to these men, combined with the information that I've been giving them about their physical allergy, is going to change the treatment of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. And that's something to ask yourself as you go through this process, as you read this book, as you read about, excuse me, what we perceive to be the problem, what the action required to attain the solution, the attitude that we need to embrace. Do we really believe on anything that these men are saying about themselves that wrote this book? Do I really believe it? When I'm balking at a particular level or course of action as we move forward, I can go back to this question and ask myself, do I really believe the words in this book? Remember the three questions we talked about last week. Did I think like that? Did I feel that way? And do I believe this program will work for me? To carry them all the way through, because it's important. Now it says, very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, MD. So here's a fun fact. So at this time, if any of you have the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, very truly yours, MD. It does not say William D. Silkworth. And the reason it does not say William D. Silkworth is because what he's about to share with us is an acknowledgement of his inability to help alcoholics and a requirement for us to walk towards a spiritual solution and take that and combine it with the physical and mental information that he's about to give us. Now, at this time in 1939, he's risking his career by writing on paper that only these powers greater than human can help these men, and we cannot help them. In 1955, the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous came out. By 1955, alcoholism was deemed a real disease. This book was working. This program was working. Dr. Silkworth went back to Bill Wilson and said, put my name in that book because I want acknowledgement for what I told you in 1939. That's how serious and dangerous for his livelihood it was for him to write these letters in this book in 1939. He would not sign his name. Fun fact. First edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, you won't find his name. The physician who, at our request, gave us a letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Now that's what we're going to be focusing on for the next 3 to 4 weeks. The body, the physical allergy. You will recognize as we go through even this chapter tonight, it will touch on the solution, the spiritual malady, the mental obsession, the course of action, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Silkworth's going to give us a little taste of everything that happens and what's required. But for what we are doing in the first part of our disease, we're going to focus on that sentence. I've suffered alcoholic torture, and I have to believe that my body is quite as abnormal as my mind. Because how long have we walked around in our alcoholism, drug addiction, food addiction, Al-Anonism, controlling, fixing, sex addiction, gambling, saying to ourselves, I am weak, I have no willpower, I should be able to control this. What is happening to me? What is happening? Why can I not control this? So what we're doing tonight is we are focusing on the fact that we suffer from an allergy, that these substances, circumstances that we're feeding our spirit to get this false sense of ease and comfort, we have no control over the amount we do or take or interact in as soon as we start. What that does, if you really get to that place, is it's going to take a little bit of heat off. Remember, we talked about in the beginning, going easy on yourself. Be gentle with yourself. So if you're going through this process and you haven't been through it before, or you're wondering why I must be weak. The truth is that if you are an alcoholic or an addict or whatever other affliction is plaguing you, you're different. And your body is reacting differently. And that's what we're focusing on. Now, this portion of our disease will never change and will never go away. Although we will seek out a spiritual solution, although we will recover from the disease of alcoholism, addiction, and the like, although our mental obsession can be relieved and our spiritual malady can be treated, the physical portion of our disease will never, ever change. If we are the real addict alcoholic, the minute we put a substance in our body, the phenomenon of craving is going to kick in, the allergy is going to take off, and we're going to be right back where we are. And later on in the book, it talks about this being progressive. So my experience is it gets worse. So the body is quite as abnormal as the mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. So just what I was just saying, the reason that I take off on this course of madness, consuming, this mass consumption, whatever it is not because I'm maladjusted to life or I'm a full flight from reality or that I'm an outright mental defective. Now, those things may play a part in this. And actually kind of touching on the malady right there, the actual driving force of this, because if I'm living a sober life and I find myself maladjusted to life, I feel like I'm a full flight from reality. I'm starting to lose my mind. I'm an outright mental defective. That's going to begin this process of me getting into the mental obsession, which is going to lead me back to the drink. But those aren't exact reasons for why I had to have another one. We have to separate it. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. So as laymen, people that aren't alcoholics, the soundness of the fact that you're an alcoholic and you have an allergy, that doesn't matter to me. And I don't even necessarily know if I believe it. But to us alcoholics and drug addicts, and sex addicts and gamblers and whatever we're doing here, that means a lot. That helps me to separate myself from you. That helps me to understand that there's a physical portion of my disease that I have zero control over and I can do nothing about. And it also reminds me that each and every time I engage in these substances, it's going to happen again. It's going to happen again. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that this explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So let it explain to you why you could not stop once you started. Not because you're crazy, not because you're weak, because you have an allergy inside your body. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. So, like I mentioned through this chapter, he's going to touch on a lot of things. And that's why it's important for you guys to study this stuff. This is your Bible, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Read it, reread it, open your mind, set aside what you think you know, engage. Right there, he's letting me know that, you know what, you may need a little bit of time away from alcohol before any of this is even going to work. And we all may experience that when we have somebody walk up to us and say, hey, can you sponsor me? And I have a day sober. You know, we may not be able to carry this message to somebody who's actively engaged in their affliction. So we need to consider that. And we need to be able to explain that to them, that maybe it'd be better if you can clear your mind a little bit. Talk to me every day, but let's get a little clear before we start talking about this program of action, the solution. More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So at the bottom of that page, we put an asterisk for allergy, and it says a condition of unusual sensitivity to a substance which in like amounts does not affect others and is characterized by systematic disorders. So just backing up the fact that we have an allergy and it separates us from other people. And I want to reiterate, be gentle with yourself. Don't beat yourself up. So now we're going to get back into what the doctor writes. It says the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. So they sent Dr. Silkworth this book. He read it. They asked him to put a chapter in this book. And his synopsis of his reading was, this is of paramount importance to people that are afflicted with alcoholic addiction. That's how he feels about it. And this is one of the best, most sought after doctors for alcoholism and addiction in the 30s. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Talk about being humble. He didn't want to put his name in it. It would have risked his career. He says that this is of paramount importance to those afflicted with this disease. And then he says he got a sense of real satisfaction when he was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. So these doctors knew that there had to be this change of thinking, this change of attitude, this understanding that we are beyond human aid, that we must rely on something greater than ourselves. And so we're in our first step and we're recognizing that we are powerless and that our life is unmanageable. Moral psychology is beginning to happen. As we walk into our second step, the real psychic change in moral psychology occurs because now I'm willing to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. The insanity that I've just talked about for the last 6 weeks. These doctors could not get these men there, and he was blown away that Bill Wilson came back to him and showed him and started working with alcoholics in his own hospital, that this was possible. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. And the asterisk here says the number one doctor for alcoholism at the time is saying that he knows that a doctor isn't capable of giving me what I need, a spiritual experience. You see, in 1939, doctors were gods. That's part of the reason why Silkworth could not put his name to this. They were the saviors of humanity. Medicine was taking off. And he's admitting right here that they're too scientific. Their standards are too ultra modern. And it makes me inequipped to apply these powers of good. And we cross out good and write God. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital. And while here, he acquired some ideas, which he put into practical application at once. So Bill Wilson came into that hospital for the last time. He had already talked with Dr. Silkworth about the physical allergy, about how he was different. He went back out, he drank again. We'll read about that in Bill's story. The third time he came into the hospital, he had met with his friend Ebbie Thatcher from the Oxford Group, who started to talk to him about the spiritual solution. In that hospital, Ebbie came to Bill and they went through the six precepts because they didn't have the 12 steps. We read those on page 263. We read those last week. And so that's why the doctor's writing right here that he came under our care in the hospital. And while he was here, he acquired some ideas, which he put into practical application at once. Bill went through the steps right then and there in his hospital room. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here. And with some misgiving, we consented because the sixth precept told Bill to go and work with other alcoholics, the same way Ebbie carried a message to him. So Bill turns right around and asks the doctors at the hospital, let me start helping these people. Now remember, they're gods. They don't want to admit they're wrong. So with some misgiving, I'm sure there was quite a bit of argument going on, they allowed Bill to help. And after they did, the cases we have followed through have been the most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. So what happened after they started to allow Bill to help others was amazing. Dr. Silkworth was blown away. And that's why he said it's inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in the alcoholic field. He spent his whole career trying to help alcoholics. And here comes Bill Wilson, and these guys are recovering. Why? Because they believe in themselves, which we're learning to do. We're different. We're not bad people. There is a solution, and we're willing to go to any lengths to get it. And still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. So these men that came back into this hospital, and Bill came back, was talking highly about the power of God and how it saved his life. And they started sharing that message. The first precept is complete deflation. Our first step is that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. So, of course, an alcoholic ought to be free from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. So, again, he's reminding us, ourselves included, think about when you walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you very, very first walked in, the time that it took prior to mustering up the willingness and the courage to ask somebody to help you and to go to this work. So we have to use compassion, empathy, understanding as we're approached in the future by people who want help. That's why we study this book so much, so that we can truly, truly help other people. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of analogy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So what happens to us with this phenomenon of craving does not happen to my wife. Just went to the Padre game. She had two Pacificos. I could not do that. I could not do that. And if I don't remember that each and every day of my recovery, I'm in trouble. Why can't I not do that? Because I have an allergy to alcohol. Period. I'm different. Once I start, I'm going to want more. And if I don't get more, you're not going to want to be around me. So we put an asterisk here that says, if the following five questions are true, the reason is a previous question. Because when I put alcohol in my system, I physically lose control of how much I drink once I've started. So these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. So the first question, can I safely use alcohol in any form? No. Why? Once having formed the habit, found I cannot break it. Once I do it, I'm forming a habit. And can I break it? No. Once having lost my self-confidence, do I lose my self-confidence? Well, of course, because I want to be able to control it and I can't. My reliance upon things human, I'm wondering why my family can't make me stop. I can't use willpower to make me stop. Why can't I just be a good dude that knows how to control his drinking and drink like a gentleman? What happens to me? Do my problems pile up on me? Absolutely. And they become astonishingly difficult to solve. I can't solve them. And it all started because I'm an allergic type and I can never safely use alcohol. Period. And that's what that transcription means. If the following five questions are true, the reason is the previous question. So we go all the way up to the top. Can I ever safely use alcohol? No. And consider when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Had you lost your self-confidence? Had you lost trust and reliance on anything human? Had your problems piled up on you and became astonishingly difficult to solve? So important to always consider this first step. I believe you pick up a drink, a drug, you're living in codependency, controlling and fixing, overeating, sex addict, gambling, whatever it may be, it's a first step problem. There is some area of your life, some aspect, let's call it a delusion, because that's what it is, a lie, that you have some power. I've got power here. That's what happens. It's not necessarily me taking will back from God. It's me saying, I've got power. I've got power. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. What does that mean? My parents asking me to stop doesn't work. My wife asking me to stop doesn't work. My kids pleading with me to stop doesn't work. My friend saying, hey man, you got a problem, doesn't work. I think a lot of us recognize that when we finally get into recovery and we see the reaction of our friends and family that are so glad that we're seeking some sort of help. It's a real testament to the life that we had been living. It's important to acknowledge how we've affected others. So if frothy emotional appeal doesn't suffice, what's going to work? The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. So it's got to run deep. I have to relate. You have to be able to show me something, basically prove to me through my own experience that yes, that's me. Yes, I thought like that. Yes, I felt like that. And yes, I believe this program can work for me. Anything less would be a half measure and it's not going to work. It's got to have depth. I mean, it's got to touch me. There's got to be an aspect of this that I really grab onto and say, wow, that's me. And it's got to have some weight. And the weight we can acknowledge as we look around in this fellowship and we engage with people that have years of sobriety, that take people through the work, that have suffered the same exact thing that we have been through. All you have to do is look around, talk to people. You will find somebody that's been through exactly what you've been through, that can relate to exactly what you're going through. That's the weight. That's the truth. That's the proof that it works. So it's got to have the depth. It's got to have the weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And our second asterisk says, I promise if my ideals are grounded in a power greater than myself, my life will be recreated. So what does being grounded look like? What does my ideals being grounded in a power greater than myself look like? I believe at this point in the process, let's acknowledge and recognize that reliance upon self is not going to work. That in itself can be enough for me to begin to get grounded in a power greater than myself. There is this desire to recover. There is this emptiness inside of me that I just can't fix on my own. And if I'm looking at a program with depth that I really see and I really relate to, and it's got weight and I'm surrounded by people that it's really working with and they're talking to me about their solution, I can begin to get grounded in this power that's bigger than me. And what happens when I begin to get grounded is my life is recreated. A new me, a new attitude, a new set of conceptions and motives, they begin to take over. A reliance upon something besides my abilities, my thinking, and my ways. And that's what we walk towards in these steps. If any feel that as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedy, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. So as doctors, all they have seen is pain and suffering and an inability to help these people. They call them doomed. Hopeless. And what they're witnessing right now, they have not been able to achieve on their own. The power of God working in these people's lives, giving them a spiritual experience, walking them towards recovery, keeping them abstinent from alcohol, which no medical procedure has ever been able to do. So that's why they are so encouraged with this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Nothing has contributed more to this rehabilitation than this altruistic movement. What's this altruistic movement? These are men who have recovered, and they're men and women today who have recovered that are carrying this message to other people that are suffering. They are sharing with them a course of action that works. They are doing this for no money, with no expectations, nothing in return. And what they're doing is they're doing God's work, and they're getting their healing as they continue this altruistic movement, and that's why it's working. So our third asterisk at the bottom here says, here Silkworth tells me why I drink. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So I drink and use because I like the effects in the beginning. But before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank and used, now as I reflect, because I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I could not differentiate the true from the false. I was seeking this solution to everything in my life. It was my answer to everything. Normal people drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I see that it's hurting me, and I continue to do it. After a time, I cannot differentiate the true from the false. What is the true from the false? To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. There's a falsity. Any of you feel that actively in your disease, it was the normal life. Everybody did it. This is what we do. It's okay. Looking back today, can we not see how much of a delusion that was? Part of this process is allowing us, it's allowing me to differentiate the true from the false. The big lie in my life. I drink because I like the effect. I get high because I like the effect. Well, then why am I getting so high in the morning before 5 a.m. to be off to work to go and start drinking at 11 because I like the effect? No, because I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and because I have zero control, period. And it's not weakness. That's what I've come to terms with. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. So here the doctor's going to touch on our spiritual malady. This is what happens when we drink, when we use, when we, whatever our affliction is. We're restless, irritable, and discontented. That's the malady. That's what happens first. That happens in sobriety, untreated alcoholism. That was happening to me in active using and drinking every day. And as it progressed, it began to happen while I was using and drinking. That's how I really started to recognize something was off. So it says they're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Part of differentiating the true from the false today is me recognizing that there never was ease and comfort in drugs and alcohol. It is very important for me to understand today that I cannot obtain ease and comfort from drugs and alcohol. And also, if I think for a minute that I'm going to experience the high that I got right away every time I did a hit, drink a beer, shot, took a pill, by getting on my knees and praying to God, then I might be in a little bit of a delusion too. So I would encourage all of you to go easy on yourself here and understand that if I look too deeply into this statement here and say, wait a minute, you're telling me that I have to at once experience the same high that I felt from drinking and using with this power of God, that's ridiculous. Well, the truth is, we're going to walk towards that. And the truth is, as you begin to seek this power in your life and to spend time with something that's pulled you back from the gates of death, there will be moments where you experience ease and comfort that far surpasses anything you ever felt drinking or using. There will be moments where you sit down with another alcoholic or addict, take them through the work, and something will happen to you in that moment that will be higher than any high you have ever felt in your life. Understanding that ease and comfort for me today can be as simple as contented sobriety, meaning that I'm comfortable in my own skin. I'm content with not drinking and using today. I'm actively engaging in this relationship that I'm building with this higher power that either I don't understand or I'm just starting to walk with, or I'm really starting to engage and grow and love. This is all about loving that power, relying on that power. The level of ease and comfort that comes to each and every one of us is different. The point is that we do need to attain a sense, that's a key word, a sense of ease and comfort in recovery, or we will revert back to being restless, irritable, and discontented, and that will drive us to a mental obsession, which will drive us to pick up a drink. So recognizing the restlessness, the irritability, and the discontentment as it's happening, and seeing that my sense of ease and comfort that I had yesterday is not necessarily here today, is the things that we acknowledge and we're aware of and that we take action behind on a regular basis, because no day is exactly the same. So after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, that's the mental obsession, the phenomenon of craving develops, and they pass through well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is little hope of his recovery. So I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism or active alcoholism. I can't find this sense of ease and comfort anywhere else. I'm living in this delusion. I can't differentiate the true from the false. My only solution is alcohol and drugs. So I succumb to this desire again. Once I succumb to that desire, the obsession, the phenomenon of craving kicks in. I drink. I go through a spree. And I wake up with the firm resolution I'm never doing this again. And I'm sure that each and every one of you have had that experience. And that's what's so deep about Silkworth's little chapter here, is that, yes, we are talking about the physical craving. But just in that short paragraph, he describes to us exactly what happens. We get restless, irritable, discontent. We succumb to the desire again because we can't find ease and comfort. The phenomenon of craving kicks in. We pass through the stages of a well-known spree. We wake up and we promise we're never doing this again. And the only hope is unless a person can experience an entire psychic change. And he says over and over how no doctor, no medicine can give us a psychic change. What with their ultra-modern standards, their scientific ways, they are unable to give us the powers that lie in God. So on the other hand, and strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary that required to follow a few simple rules. So right there, he's talking about the mental obsession again, which a lot of people here have been through the steps. They've got time and sobriety. Their mental obsession has been removed. You've experienced that. How are we going to hang on to that? We're required to follow a few simple rules. The reason why you're sitting here in a workshop. Because we want to continue to follow simple rules. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. And there's a must in the left margin there that says, can I stay stopped on my own? Very important question for all of us to ask ourselves. Do I need help? The asterisk at the top says, do I believe that in recovery I must experience the sense of ease and comfort that I get by drinking? If not, will I give in to the desire to drink again? So faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. So at the top paragraph, it says, unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. And the sentence I just read says that one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. What does something more than human power look like in your life today? Those are the kind of questions that we are going to carry with us as we move forward in these steps. Am I willing to rely on it? Am I willing to acknowledge that I have this allergy, that I can never put this in my body? Otherwise, I'll be off and running on this spree again. What does this power look like? How do I achieve this psychic change? That's what this book's about. That's what this process is about. That's what we're sitting here for. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, so they've had success, just not with the hopeless variety of alcoholics and drug addicts. We physicians must admit that we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. So a perfect example of relating to this book and finding your own experience in this book is going back to a time in your life where something was coming up, something was going on, and I didn't meet my responsibilities because of this phenomenon of craving. And how I beat the crap out of myself after that and because of that. And how I ran it through my head over and over and over again. And how I get to this place of, man, I need some help. Man, I'm just weak. And what am I going to do? What we are focusing on today is the reason why that happened. Because the phenomenon of craving became paramount to all other interests. That's the only reason. It didn't matter what I was thinking at the time. It didn't matter what I was praying at the time. It didn't matter if I did or didn't pick up the phone and ask somebody for help, once I put that substance in my body, that phenomenon of craving became of paramount importance to me. And the important thing for all of us to remember is that that will happen every time. Every single time. If you are an alcoholic. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. So we go back to this whole ease and comfort situation, this scenario where I'm in this delusion that I'm doing this drinking to feel better, to get some ease and comfort. But the truth, when I differentiate the true from the false and I'm learning about my disease, I get to see that I really am not drinking to escape. Once I put that in my body, I am now drinking to overcome this craving that is beyond my mental control. I cannot control it. And it's important for me to connect the two so that I can see that once I start, it has nothing to do with me trying to escape. It has nothing to do with me trying to reach this sense of ease and comfort. If I was truly looking to gain a sense of ease and comfort, I would get up in the morning, I would eat my breakfast, I would go to my career, I would come home, I would have dinner, and I'd have like a glass of wine. Or maybe I'd go out in the garage and like smoke a joint. And that would be it. And I would relax. And I would feel ease and comfort and the stress of my day relieved. And I would have conversation with my spouse or friend or roommate. And then I would go to bed. Now, if any of us would have the ability to do that, we surely would not be here in a workshop doing the step work. So it's really important to differentiate the true from the false and differentiate us from other people. Because if I get restless, irritable, and discontented in sobriety, and I even have an inkling that drugs and alcohol are going to help with that, I just may be in trouble. So it's important for me to understand the nature of this allergy, how it will never go away, why I was really doing it after I started, and how it's the biggest lie I've ever told myself that it's going to solve my problems. And most important, once I start, I won't be able to stop, and that is never going to go away. So there are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. So think of all the people that have gotten to this place that have no knowledge of this. This is a testament to how important this knowledge, this will save your life and has saved millions of people's lives. All the people that had no idea about their phenomenon of craving, their allergies, that they were different than their fellows. They weren't able to take the heat off. They weren't able to go easy on themselves, to ask somebody for help, to work a program of action. What happened? I give up. Madness. Enough. Suicide. The supreme sacrifice. That's what happens. We get so crazy from this inability to control that we commit suicide. That's how serious this disease is. Rather than continue to fight, what we are doing here tonight is continue to fight. We are acknowledging our disease. We are acknowledging that we suffer from a craving beyond our mental control. We are acknowledging that it's never going to go away. And we're continuing to fight. And most important in our first step, when we truly acknowledge powerlessness, we acknowledge the fact that we cannot fight this fight. That we must be grounded in a power greater than ourselves in order to fight this fight. In order to keep ourselves grounded in the solution. In something more than human power. All we did was fight before we got here. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions, never a decision. There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, that he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normally in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. So there's a description, and this is another way for us to study this book and look at, yeah, that's me. Oh, that's me. That's right. I mean, I like to think, well, I'm entirely normal and I'm a great person. And except when I get loaded, that's not necessarily true. You know, when I look at the definition of psychopath over here, that's more like me. You know, a person characterized by emotional instability, lack of sound judgment, perverse and impulsive behavior, inability to learn from experience. Okay. So now if I'm being honest, that's more like me. But it doesn't matter which one we are. What matters is that we see, I thought like that, I felt like that, I drank like that. I believe that this can work for me. All these and many others have one symptom in common. And this is what matters. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. I am different. I'm not different than most of you here, which is our common bond. And we have a common solution. It's the cement that binds us. We'll talk about that as we move forward. It's a great thing. But important for me to understand, I'm different than most people. And it's not weakness. But I can't fight that fight on my own. Those are aspects of my recovery that have to be relived all the time. All the time. Because the further I get away from it, the easier it is for me to not really acknowledge it anymore. Because now I'm this man of God walking this path and everything's great and I get this ease and comfort and I want to show you what it takes to recover. But the truth is it may be of utmost importance for me to just stop, to remember the fight. To remember my problems piling up on me. To remember feeling like nothing could help me. To remember the hopelessness that was involved. To remember the allergy that I suffer from. It helps me to relate to new people that come in this program and look at me and say, hey, Jason, can you help me out? I've been guilty of, oh yeah, sure. Get on your knees. Let's talk about God. Well, we're going to walk to that. Slowly. So this phenomenon of craving we suggested, oh, I said that, different than the entity. It has never been by any treatment which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. So the only thing that keeps us free from this phenomenon of craving is not drinking. Not using, not engaging in whatever our affliction may be. It's super important for us to walk towards abstinence. The problem that we face is that we cannot remain abstinent on our own. We cannot stay stopped on our own. And repeated acknowledgement of that is the essence of recovery. It's the essence of humility and surrender to the fact that I'm different. I can't have abstinence by myself. So this immediately precipitates into a seething cauldron of debate with the doctors, is what he's talking about. So now all of a sudden they're arguing about, wait a minute, you're saying we can't help them? Yes, we can. No, we can't. Yes, we can. Oh, look, I have proof spiritual solution works. We can't help these people with the psychic change, the moral psychology. We know it's required. So they're going back and forth. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the one thing they agree on, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. So after all of this and Dr. Silkworth's understanding and his experience and what he's seeing, there's still so many physicians around that just say these people are hopeless. They're doomed. They're doomed. We do not have to be doomed today. We are going to continue to fight, but we're not going to fight on our own. That attitude has changed amongst doctors today. But if any of you have ever been in treatment anywhere, any place in the country, at the end of every treatment, they tell you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. All of them. Because that's their acknowledgement of, look, we're going to give you cognitive behavioral therapy. We're going to give you grief counseling. We're going to have family night. We're going to allow you to sit in a circle and make amends to your families and do all. And I speak from experience. Both of my children were in inpatient recovery as teenagers. And I put them there actively using and drinking, thinking that they were the problem. But after all of that, all they ever said to my children was go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God I finally came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for myself. I took both my sons there, my dad there, my brother there. Never went there for myself because I didn't have this problem. Because you guys were weak. And there's no way I was going to be a failure. These are elements of me, of my truth. These are elements of me differentiating the truth from the false. That's my experience. And it's important for me to share things like that with you guys so that you understand that I have had a real experience with this, and I've come to terms with some very hard truths, some difficult things in my own life, because I want to inspire you guys to do the same. And if you've already found some, I want to inspire you to find more. I want to inspire you to get some more depth, some more weight, to become more grounded, to let those roots grow deeper. So what is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him, there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features. But there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck, restless, irritable, discontented, had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. Self-reliance and contentment. Contented sobriety, ease, and comfort. This man had found a way to be living in a sense of ease and comfort. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. I believe the guy's name was Hank Parker, and he was one of the first AAs. And he went back to Silkworth. And Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson helped him. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. That physician was Dr. Bob, brought him in. This is a story of Fitzmayo, who his stories, the third story, I believe, in the personal stories called Our Southern Friend. He was like the fourth or fifth AA. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. So he worked this program. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then. He is a fine specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through and through. Perhaps he came to scoff. He may remain to pray. So at the end of all this, Dr. Silkworth is earnestly advising us to read this book through. And though perhaps we came to scoff, perhaps there's some level of contentment prior to investigation, his only hope is that we remain to pray, that we remain to become grounded in this power greater than ourselves, that we remain to experience this moral psychology, this psychic change that he admitted over and over that he completely was unable to give to people. And that doctors today are still unable to give to people. So that was the doctor's opinion, guys. And I want to end with something here for you. And then I'll pray us out.
Yeah, I don't always feel it. Yeah, but that's when I need it the most. So I'm gonna keep on singing. Till my soul catches up with my song. There's times when my hands go up freely. Times that it calls. There's days when a praise comes out easy. Days when it takes all the strength I got. I'll bring my heart, fought, heartfelt, been through hell. Hallelujah. And I'll bring my storm, tossed, torn self, story to tell. Hallelujah. Oh, oh, oh. 'Cause God, you've been patient. God, you've been gracious. Trying to reach for the light. Yeah, the struggle keeps me honest. And it breaks down the walls of my pride. 'Cause faith isn't proven like gold till it's been through the fire. Oh, my head, heart, and hands are feeling heavy. Yeah.
So the next assignment will be assignment 3, which is Bill's story, and go buy your sponsorship guide, and that will direct you. I'll send it an email. I'll send the recordings out best I can. I'm trying Dropbox and also links, and a lot of people weren't here tonight, so we'll see where that goes. So let me say a prayer for us. May the Lord bless you and protect you.
Bless you.
May the Lord smile on you and be gracious to you. May the Lord show you his favor and give you his peace. Amen.
Amen. Good night, Jason.
Amen. Good night, guys.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, everyone. Good night, Jason.
You are welcome.
Thank you, thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Love you, Jason. See you next week.
It's really great.
Teach you guys.
Right on.